Welcome to the Science Podcast for January 11th, 2013. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This week, some consequences of China's one-child policy, the promise and peril of so-called expert networks, and reviewing the role of inflammation in chronic disease.
Inflammation, once it gets going, can lead to tissue destruction. So the very elements of inflammation that can destroy invading organisms can also destroy host tissue.
Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org. This podcast is also sponsored by Audible.com, home to over 100,000 audiobooks.
China's one-child policy was instituted in the late 1970s to slow population growth, particularly in urban centers. Many experts agree it has averted hundreds of millions of births, but there have been consequences unrelated to population control, such as a distinct lack of siblings. What does it mean for the social development of kids to be raised solo? How has the preponderance of one-child families affected China as a whole? I spoke with Lisa Cameron about her team's attempt, using experimental economics measures, to answer some of these questions.
The first aim is to examine the behavioral impacts of the one-child policy. And then secondly, more broadly, we're interested in the impact of growing up as an only child. One of the novel aspects of the paper is that we used experimental techniques from the experimental economics literature to measure behavior like altruism, trustworthiness, trustingness, and so forth. And we then supplement that with some personality survey questions. And in essence, what we find is that being born under the one-child policy and being an only child as a result of the policy results in people being less trusting, less trustworthy, more risk-averse, less competitive. So they're the experimental results. And then from the personality survey, we find evidence that people born under one-child policy and who are only children as a result of the policy are less conscientious, more pessimistic, and there's some evidence that they're also slightly more neurotic.
Mm-hmm. Well, can we start with what is the one-child policy? How long has it been in effect, and what does it require from Chinese citizens?
Okay. So the one-child policy was implemented in June 1979. It's been imposed largely on the urban population, and it requires that parents with urban hukou, so that's urban residency status, can only have one child. And there are various exemptions, mainly in rural areas. It depends on the province. You can have another child if your first child is a girl. There are some other variations in terms of leniency. But in urban areas, it's been largely strictly enforced, particularly in the large urban areas. And our sample's from Beijing for that reason, because we wanted to examine the impact of the policy in a context where it was strictly imposed.
So how much of an impact has the one-child policy had on the areas that you study, the urban centers?
Say if we compare cohorts that were born in different years for the urban centers of Shanghai, Nanjing, and Guangzhou, mm-hmm. 20% of people born in 1975 are only children.
Right.
In contrast, if you look at people who were born in 1990 in those cities, then 80% of people in those cities are only children.
So on the surface, the result of this policy has been to reduce the number of children born to Chinese parents, but there have been some unexpected side effects on the life histories of these kids. What kind of effects did you look into specifically, and why?
If you look at the popular media in the West, but also particularly in China, then you'll see there's a lot of discussion of little emperors, which mm-hmm. is in the title of our paper. There's been this concern about the social development of these children. You know, then we discovered that nobody had really looked into it in a very structured way. Also, because we'd all had experience of experimental economics, which really enables you to look at very fine-tuned types of behavior, because you're really trying to isolate in these experiments, which I can explain in a second if you like, you're trying to isolate a particular type of behavior. And so it's particularly good for measuring and identifying differences in behavior between different groups or for particular reasons. And so we thought the tools of experimental economics would be helpful in this setting.
So you saw kind of a popular conception in China that little emperors were a phenomena, and then you decided to look into that with these tools.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
And so how exactly did you go about measuring the little emperor effect?
Okay, so first of all, we decided we'd try and recruit a sample of participants from Beijing as representative of the population as possible. In the paper, we spent some time looking at the representativeness of the sample. So then with these people, we invited them to participate in games where they could earn money. We actually played four games with the participants, and then we also conducted a survey after the experiments were completed. And we chose just four general, very well-established games in the experimental literature, which are called the dictator game, the trust game, a particular type of risk game, and a competition game. They're designed to elicit how altruistic people are, how trusting, how trustworthy, mm-hmm. how risk-averse, and how competitive people are. And these were behaviours that people talk about, you know, with respect to only children in terms of social skills, ability to cooperate, and those kind of characteristics.
So you compared cohorts of children born 2 years before the law was implemented and then 2 years after. So they're not that different in age, but they were grew up in much different family settings. How did these two different groups fare?
Okay. So if we compare the pre- and post-one-child policy cohorts, then we find quite stark differences in their behaviour. If we talk about trust, the trust game is a pretty simple game where you have people paired. So there's a player one and player two. Player one was given 100 yuan and was told that they could give some of that money if they so desired to player two. And any money that they decided to give to player two would be doubled, and then player two would have an opportunity to give some of that money back. So player one's behaviour is interpreted as being a measure of trust because player one has to trust player two in order to pass some money to player two. Mm-hmm. So say 100 yuan, player one might decide to pass 40 yuan, player two will receive 80 yuan, and then player two's behaviour is interpreted as being trustworthiness because then player two can give some of that 80 yuan back if he or she so desires. But there's no requirement that player two gives any of that money back. So we look at differences in the amounts given, amounts returned. And one thing I should emphasise is that this is real money and it was quite a sizable amount. And so if you look at the difference between the pre- and post-cohorts for the trust game, those born after the one-child policy was implemented sent, on average, 7% less of the amount that they were given in the trust game. So they were significantly less trusting of the other player. Mm-hmm. And player twos who were born after the imposition of the one-child policy return, on average, 6% less to player one. That is compared with those who were born before the imposition of the one-child policy. And again, that's statistically significant mm-hmm. and reasonably sizable. So we're finding that basically that the impact of the policy was to reduce people's ability to trust and also reduce people's trustworthiness.
And you also saw effects in risk aversion?
That's right. We found really large effects in risk aversion with the people born under the one-child policy were significantly more risk averse. And we also saw quite large effects in the competition game. There was a task which was actually just adding up three-digit numbers, and they could be paid a piece rate, or they could choose to compete with someone else, and if they won that competition, they actually got paid more than they would have in the piece rate. We found that those people who were born under the one-child policy were significantly less likely to choose to compete, even though it turns out that they ended up being more able.
You did do a lot of work to eliminate alternative hypotheses for these differences that you're seeing in your pre- and post-law cohorts.
Yeah.
For example, the difference between, you know, having a lot of extended family, that did not make a difference, right?
No, that's right. So, well, it turns out that in the cohorts that we examine, there's really only a very minor difference in the extent of extended family. Mm-hmm. So in the pre-cohort, they had on average 7.4 cousins, whereas our post-one-child policy cohorts had on average 7 cousins. So right. really, we're not in a position to examine extended family effects using this data, mm-hmm. which is actually fortunate for us in that we can be more confident saying, look, this is a one-child effect. It's not to do with having a smaller extended family. It's right. actually about being the only child in your nuclear family.
But has the size of extended families declined since the early 80s when your second cohort was
Yes, and it has markedly. And so we actually conclude the paper saying that we would imagine these days with the policy impacting not just in the nuclear family but resulting in people having no aunts and uncles, no cousins, that if anything that would strengthen the effects that we're finding. So our take on it is that the effects that we're finding are probably a lower bound estimate of the effects of the one-child policy because they don't take into account an extended family effect.
So how does this policy and the fact that these kids are being raised alone actually work itself into a mechanism for these changes in behavior?
Well, we spend some time trying to look at that in the paper. So we look at how often they interacted with cousins in early childhood and whether they're in childcare, and we find that that has no effect on behavior. Mm-hmm. And we also look at the attributes that parents encouraged in children, and we do find that people born under the one-child policy were less likely to report that their parents encouraged them not to be selfish, encouraged them to trust in others, mm-hmm. and so forth. So the data that we have is suggestive that parenting plays quite a role in this, and it may just be an unintentional thing that when you're growing up without other siblings, there aren't so many opportunities that arise naturally for parents to say, oh, you know, you need to work together, or, you know, right. to build on trust. Whereas when you're growing up as an only child, those opportunities don't arise so naturally.
Great. Well, Lisa Cameron, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thanks, too.
Lisa Cameron and colleagues write about China's one-child policy in this week's Science.
During mosquito season, no matter how much bug spray you apply, the result is inevitably the same. Red, itchy bumps wherever the mosquitoes find their way to your skin. The good news is that acute inflammation, while annoying, is a protective measure initiated by the body to remove harmful stimuli and protect tissue from damage. However, more continuous stimuli can trigger longer-term inflammation, which in turn contributes to chronic diseases like diabetes, Alzheimer's disease, and atherosclerosis, or hardening of the arteries. Ira Tabis walked me through his review of anti-inflammatory therapy in chronic disease, beginning with how inflammation can go wrong.
Inflammation, once it gets going, can lead to tissue destruction. So the very elements of inflammation that can destroy invading organisms can also destroy host tissue. And when tissues get damaged, it can lead to tissue dysfunction. And that dysfunction can lead to either acute or chronic symptoms. So, for example, in the case of arthritis, patients experience daily pain. In the case of atherosclerosis, the inflammation can lead to acute heart attacks.
So there are clearly many diseases here associated with inflammation, many of which are highly prevalent, as you said.
Correct.
There's clearly an urgency there to be able to effectively treat these diseases. Anti-inflammatory therapy has a lot of promise, but there are some significant challenges. So what are the challenges of targeting inflammation therapeutically?
I think that inflammation has evolved over the millennia in a very sophisticated manner, such that if you try to target it, there can be redundancy. So you target one part of the inflammatory pathway, but there's another part that just takes over. Mm. And then perhaps most challenging is that inflammation is there for a reason. It's there to protect our bodies. And if we get rid of it, then we are leaving ourselves susceptible to invasion by pathological organisms. And the window of opportunity is often very narrow. So that's one set of challenges that has to do with what inflammation is all about. And then another set of challenges fits into the sort of category of early versus late treatment. So in order to have its greatest impact, you want to try to stop the inflammation before it causes irreversible tissue destruction.
Mm-hmm.
And that sounds fine, but the problem is, A, you've got to identify the disease process early enough. And for certain, many of these diseases, they're lifelong diseases or diseases that last decades. So if you get poison ivy, you can take steroids as anti-inflammatory therapy for a week. But for some of these diseases, if you treated them early enough, you would potentially need to take them for decades. And the longer you take these treatments, the more side effects there are. Whereas if you intervene too late, then you run the risk of not being able to reverse the damage that's already been done. And then the third challenge, I think, is monitoring effectiveness. That if somebody is having daily symptoms, then you can at least monitor relief of those symptoms. For example, relief of pain. If you've got an easily measurable endpoint, so in diabetes, it's very easy to measure blood sugar, then that becomes very feasible. But in cases like atherosclerosis or Alzheimer's disease, monitoring effectiveness can be very, very challenging. How do you know what you're doing is working? And so that's another challenge that needs to be dealt with.
Right. So we have really a lot of diseases associated with inflammation and then many kinds of actual inflammatory responses to those diseases. And so what is the state of anti-inflammatory treatment? How successful are the therapies currently in use?
You can think of these inflammatory diseases, I think, in three categories. So in the most straightforward type of chronic inflammatory disease, you have diseases where there is a definitive primary inflammatory defect. And these are often very rare genetic diseases. So in those sorts of diseases where it begins and ends with a specific inflammatory pathway, anti-inflammatory therapy has been very good. Then the next level up from that are diseases where the inflammation is caused by a clear autoimmune response. And the classic example of this is rheumatoid arthritis. And for years, people have had very good symptomatic relief using anti-inflammatory drugs like ibuprofen. And so those drugs make you feel better, but they don't do much for the disease. And then over the last two decades, people have become interested in these disease-modifying agents that not only relieve symptoms, but at least could, in theory, if started early enough, actually block tissue destruction. And the classic example in rheumatoid arthritis is anti-TNF-alpha therapy. It has revolutionized treatment in the more difficult cases of rheumatoid arthritis. It's far from perfect. If you're giving it late in the disease, even though it may help symptoms, there's not a lot of data that it's actually going to block disease progression. But I think all in all, taking a disease that can be utterly crippling, anti-TNF-alpha therapy has been a revolution. And then finally, you get to the most complicated and ironically the most prevalent inflammatory diseases, which are the ones that don't have a primary inflammatory trigger, nor are they thought to be primarily autoimmune, but have some other stimulus that triggers the inflammation, like tissue destruction on a chronic persistent basis. And examples of that would be like atherosclerosis, obesity leading to diabetes, neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's. And those were clearly in the experimental phase. In the case of atherosclerosis, there are two clinical trials going on now using low-dose methotrexate, which is a drug that fights inflammation by mechanisms that are not entirely known, and then an antibody that binds an inflammatory cytokine called interleukin-1 beta. And so those, we have no idea if they're going to be successful because they're in clinical trials.
So what's next? Where is all of this research headed? As you said, there's really quite a lot still in development. What's the current focus of anti-inflammatory therapeutic research?
Right. So, you know, I think you need to begin at the beginning. The reason why inflammation gets triggered in these diseases and then ultimately leads to disease progression is because there's some stimulus that doesn't go away. Okay, so that's the very basic point. For example, if you have a splinter in your finger, you take out the splinter, right? That's the first thing you do. The problem with these chronic diseases, whether they're autoimmune diseases or diseases like atherosclerosis or Alzheimer's, is that the stimulus is persistent and it's very difficult to remove. So using atherosclerosis as an example, the most important principle is to lower the cholesterol or the lipoproteins in your blood because that is the stimulus for the inflammation in atherosclerosis. That is first and foremost, is lower the stimulus, take out the splinter. And there are actually some innovative ways in the future where we may be able to do that. For example, and again, I'll just stick with the paradigm of atherosclerosis, the reason why these lipoproteins cause a problem is they stick in the arterial wall on certain molecules. And there are some innovative ways to prevent the sticking above and beyond just lowering them in your blood. And so that would represent a futuristic sort of treatment that has to do with removing the stimulus.
Hmm.
And then another major future development, I think everybody would agree, is targeted therapy. As I mentioned, one of the biggest challenges is that narrow window between suppressing the inflammation and yet not suppressing host defense. But if you could get the anti-inflammatory drug just to the site of the disease and not to other places in your body, you could definitely widen that window. And so there's some very clever strategies to design drugs so they're targeted to specific sites. And then I think the last area, which is one that I'm particularly interested in and intrigued by, is to take advantage of the body's own mechanisms for turning off inflammation. So every time you have a normal inflammatory event, your body has a very sophisticated mechanism for turning it off and for repairing your tissues, and we call that inflammation resolution. And we're learning more and more about what triggers inflammation resolution after you have an inflammatory response and the molecules that mediate it. For example, regulatory T cells are often the white blood cell that is called into play to try to calm down inflammation and restore tissue homeostasis. And through clever vaccination techniques, there are ways to try to activate regulatory T cells under certain conditions. And I think the last point I'll make about this inflammation resolution strategy is that in many cases, it specifically will not block host defense. And in fact, when your body undergoes inflammation resolution, it can often help fight invasive organisms. And so one of the advantages of trying to learn more about using inflammation resolution mediators is that it may really widen the window of opportunity by not or minimally suppressing your host defense.
Right. Well, an exciting future. Ira Tabus, thank you so much.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Ira Tabus and co-author Christopher Glass review anti-inflammatory therapy in chronic disease as part of this week's special issue on inflammation. You can find more reviews and related articles from Science Signaling at www.sciencemag.org/special/inflammation.
This week's podcast is sponsored by Audible.com. Audible has over 100,000 audiobooks, including titles like Connectome, How the Brain's Wiring Makes Us Who We Are by Sebastian Sung, or books like The Great Animal Orchestra, Finding Origins of Music in the World's Wild Places by Bernie Krause. Right now, Audible is offering a free audiobook download of your choice just for checking them out. When you sign up for a free trial at audiblepodcast.com/sciencemag, you get a free book and you support the Science Podcast. If you choose not to continue the trial, you can cancel and keep the audiobook. That address again is audiblepodcast.com/sciencemag.
Sometimes it's not who you know, but what you know. A few obvious routes to monetizing knowledge include patents, expert testimony, writing nonfiction books, and even academic journals. In a News Focus this week, Jeff Mervis writes about a big business approach to buying expertise for investing advice. I spoke with him about some of the inherent risks in selling consulting services via a third-party hookup.
Well, I think these expert network firms are not well known to most people, even the ones who participate. But over the last 15 years, I think they've become a significant player in this effort to try to make money from knowledge, is what it comes down to.
So what exactly are expert networks? Who might participate in them, and what are they needed for?
Well, the largest firm, and the one we focus on in this story, began because its founders realized in talking with physicians and physician researchers that there was a lot of money going into new biotech companies and medical devices in the 90s, but that the people making the investments didn't necessarily know as much about the field as they should. They may not have known the current treatments and current practices, and that there was a mismatch, and a lot of money was going into projects and trials and drugs that weren't going to succeed. And so they saw an opportunity to create a business which would link the experts, the knowledgeable scientists, physicians, and the like, with the people who needed to know that knowledge, whether they are stock analysts, venture capitalists, or consulting companies or other people who use that knowledge to then make money, to invest the money of their clients or their own money.
Hmm. So let's talk about some of the risks associated with participating in this type of scheme. Can you give some examples?
Well, the biggest risk is that the expert will go over the line. And by that I mean that experts, by their nature, are participating in activities that are proprietary or that involve confidential information, whether it's the results of a drug trial or company's stock, a company's products, or anything else. And they need to keep that confidential. The clients, on the other hand, obviously are looking for an edge in the market. And so they're looking for information that isn't necessarily public. But there's a difference between information that isn't public and information that is illegal to transmit. And it's the former, where if you cross the line, you can get in trouble with the Justice Department. And the most recent case in November, which was the peg for this story, involved a trader who used knowledge obtained from an expert through an expert network firm and resulted in what the Department of Justice says is $276 million in ill-gotten profits.
That's the money involved for the investors. What about for the consultants or the experts? What kind of money do they get paid?
Well, they get paid an hourly consultant rate, and that varies depending on their expertise in their field. It can be anywhere from $250 to $1,000 an hour. What expert network firms are doing is expanding the traditional consulting arrangement. The traditional arrangement is the expert would be contacted by an individual, a company or an individual, and say, we want to talk to you about X or Y, and they would arrange the conversation and pay them. The expert network firm professionalizes that in the sense that they say, we will handle all that arrangements. We will be the matchmaker. We will pay the expert his or her hourly fee. In return, we will get paid by clients to give them access to our database of experts, and then we will handle all the paperwork. We will make sure that people are paid. We will also make sure that they are told what the law is on confidentiality, on conflict of interest, what they should and shouldn't participate in. And the hope is that that will keep it on a more professional basis. And for the most part, it does. But of course, there are exceptions, and the exceptions are what gets into the newspaper.
Well, can you give us a concrete example of, say, what an investor might want advice on?
Okay, so an investor, a client, might be interested in investing in a company that's developing a new medical device or a new treatment for leukemia. And they want to know what the experts in this field say about current treatments, about current devices, and whether they would use this new drug were it to get FDA approval or a new device. That's in the medical area. Now, the same thing is true in lots of other fields, in communication, in real estate, commercial products. They want to test their knowledge, which is limited, with what the experts know, which is much greater. And as a result of that, they can make decisions or they can advise their clients to make decisions on where to put their money.
Okay. The experts that you spoke with, people who are working for these expert networks, only agreed to speak to you anonymously or to be published anonymously. Why was that?
Well, that's interesting, actually, because they gave different reasons. It's not that what they're doing is illegal, certainly, but one of them, for example, was worried that he might say something that the expert network firm might object to. And since the firm provides him with his clients, that would cut off a source of revenue. Another person was concerned that his or her university might look askance, even though universities are supposed to have comprehensive rules on consulting and what constitutes a potential conflict of interest. A third person just didn't want his name associated with something that's been in the news in a negative light,
mm-hmm.
and said, in effect, you know, I have a whole career. I would rather keep my name out of it.
So you mentioned some of the safeguards that academic institutions have on consulting by people who work there. Are there any that directly address networks like this?
It's a good question. Most universities consider this just to be another type of consulting. And their response is generally disclosure. And then if that disclosure reveals a potential problem, dealing individually with that situation. But some institutions, a few, and the Cleveland Clinic is probably a leading example, have decided that consulting for expert network firms is a different breed of animal, even though it is consulting. And they have put together much more stringent rules in an effort, frankly, they admit, to discourage their physician scientists from consulting for expert network firms. They feel that the risk of running into problems that would besmirch the name of the institution are greater than the potential benefit of conveying expert knowledge to investors. And they separate that from the kind of direct consulting where a physician might be on a scientific advisory board or may be advising on a clinical trial or may be working with a drug company on developing a new device. The clinic's argument is we know where that information is going if they're dealing with company X. But through an expert network firm, we don't know because it goes through this third party, and we're not comfortable having our people convey that information to a third party that we don't have a direct relationship with.
Okay. Well, so there was a really big case of this coming to light in November of a misuse of an expert network. But in general, how widespread would you say that this problem would
be? Well, I think it's impossible to say. And I think the Justice Department would certainly say any example of insider trading is wrong, should be prosecuted to the full extent, and should be a warning to the scientific community as well as the investment community that that is illegal as well as being unethical. Beyond that, no one is keeping track of how many relationships cross the line and whether they do it in small or large steps. The expert network firms argue that they are a break wall against a worse situation where there would be no rules and no oversight, what they call the Wild West. But nobody knows what that would actually look like.
All right. Well, Jeff Mervis, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
Jeff Mervis is a deputy news editor for Science. He writes about expert networks in a News Focus this week.
Finally today, I'm here with online news editor David Grimm, who's here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our online daily news site. So, Dave, our first story offers new insight into the effects of a mission to Mars.
Well, that's right, Carrie. One of the big problems about traveling to Mars is it takes such a long time. Researchers estimate that a mission to Mars would take about 520 days. That includes the several months to get there, the time that the astronauts would actually spend on the planet itself, and then the journey back home. And the most amount of time a human has spent outside of Earth was 437 days. That was a Russian cosmonaut in 1994 to 1995. So very little is known about what impact such an extended mission would have on the human body, and that's what this new study is all about.
So we can't just send people to Mars in a practice mission. So how are we studying that from down here on Earth?
Well, the researchers utilized an experiment that's already ongoing. This is the Mars 500 mission. This is a simulation that was going on in Moscow, just ended in 2011. And like the real Mars mission, it lasted 520 days. It involved six crewmen who spent the entire time in this sort of mock spaceship that had a sort of series of tunnel-like chambers. It wasn't the most comfortable environment. When the crew members wanted to speak to the outside world, they had to use things like video and other technology that would be on a real mission. And the point was to really replicate an actual Mars mission as well as possible.
And so what did we find? How did these crew members fare?
Well, what happened was the crew members suffered from something called hypokinesis, which is sort of a complicated way of saying they moved around a lot less. They moved less while they were awake and while they were asleep. They spent more of their waking hours engaged in restful activities, playing video games, reading books, watching movies. They even wore these wristwatches that were equipped with light sensors that showed just how lethargic they became. And actually, the more lethargic they became, the more they shunned the lighted parts of the ship. And this got worse and worse as the mission progressed. In fact, the crew members only started to perk up when they were about 20 days from the mission ending. And the researchers say that's probably because they were just really excited to get the heck out of there.
Right. So what does this mean for future space missions then?
Well, researchers say actually this is really important. You can imagine if you've got a mission and something goes wrong, you really want your crew to be alert, to be on top of things. If everybody's starting to get really sort of slothful, and a lot of these crew members, they were starting to sleep longer, they were not synchronized as well with each other's schedules as they have been at the beginning of the mission, little things like this start to really break down the group cohesion, the ability of a team to respond to dangers, to the important parts of the mission. So researchers say we really need to find a way to keep crew members more active, you know, whether it's changing the lighting in the ship or doing something else that will really sort of keep them at the top of their game throughout the entire mission.
Okay, and up next, what carry-on flies can tell us about biodiversity.
These are flies that go after dead bodies. The researchers in the study looked at a couple of different flies. One was called the blowfly, and the other one very sumptuously called the flesh fly. And the whole point of the study is, how do you track the biodiversity of a forest? That's actually a very difficult thing to do. You can imagine forests are full of just lush vegetation, hidden places. When an animal dies, it's very hard to find it. And researchers, you know, will spend years going through a landscape and really just scratching the surface of the number of species that live there, the kind of species that live there. And this study is really all about, can we get these flies to do the work for us?
Tell me how that would work.
Well, how it works is these flies actually feed on dead animals. Anybody who's seen a dead animal in the street knows they tend to attract flies. Well, the animals in these forests, and the specific forests that the researchers looked at, were actually forests in the Ivory Coast in Madagascar. And the researchers said, well, look, there's animals dying left and right that we're not seeing, but we know the flies are going after them. What if we just capture the flies, took the DNA out of the flies to figure out what these flies have been eating, and use that DNA to figure out which sort of animals are out there in the forest?
So how did this work?
Well, it actually worked pretty well. The researchers in this study, they trapped 115 flies at random in these two forests, and they found that 40% of the flies contained identifiable DNA fragments from a total of 20 mammal taxa and two bird species and an amphibian. And in fact, in one of the forests, the catch represented 13% of the documented mammal community. Now, that may not sound like a lot, but it just means that just based on this one sort of simple experiment, the researchers were able to account for 13% of the kinds of animals that were out there, which is actually pretty impressive. Mm-hmm. And what the researchers say, which is also kind of cool, is that this technique may actually even help them find animals they weren't even aware of. If they all of a sudden find DNA that matches an animal that they didn't even know existed, all of a sudden these flies are helping us find potentially new species out there.
Right. So it sounds like a really valuable tool.
Exactly.
But it also totally makes sense. So has this technique ever been tried before?
Well, researchers have actually shown something similar with leeches. They have found that leeches, because they suck blood, also contain the DNA of a variety of species, although they feast on far fewer species than the carrion flies do. But what's kind of interesting is you can imagine that the biologists would sort of have this toolbox that they could use. They could have the flies for something, the leeches for something, and maybe bats or, you know, another animal that feasts on other animals for something else. And by combining all these different animals, they actually basically have this virtual search party that goes out into the forest for them. All they have to do is capture these animals and take their DNA and figure out what's living out there.
How cool. And I love it when researchers investigate the science behind everyday occurrences. And this last story takes a look at the puckered skin that we get after a long bath.
Right. One of the downsides of taking a long bath is your fingers start to look pretty gross and wrinkly. For a long time, scientists thought that this was caused by osmosis. The idea was that the water from the tub was actually getting into the cells of your skin, causing your skin to sort of deform a little bit. But actually, it turns out that it has nothing to do with osmosis. It actually has everything to do with your nervous system. There's something about the nerves that trigger the constriction of blood vessels beneath the skin, which reduces the volume of the tissues, which actually gives you that wrinkled appearance. In fact, people that have had the tips of their fingers cut off and reattached often can't form wrinkles on their fingers anymore, which is really weird. But we already knew all that. We knew that the nervous system was involved. But what we didn't know was, what's the purpose of wrinkles? Do they actually have a purpose? Why do they form in the first place? And that's sort of what this new study is all about.
So I imagine the experimental part of this research could be really fun. Did everyone just sit around in a tub?
No, not exactly. Unfortunately, the volunteers in the study didn't sit in the tub. They soaked their hands for about 30 minutes in water. And then the researchers had them do some manipulation with their hands. They basically had the volunteers pick up 45 submerged objects, things like glass marbles and lead fishing weights, from a bin one at a time with their right hand, and passed it through a postage stamp size hole in a barrier with their left hand, and then dropped them through another hole in a box. And when the subjects did this with wrinkly fingertips underwater, they completed the task about 12% faster than they had when their fingers hadn't been soaked. And what was even more interesting was that when their fingers were wrinkled and they tried this task outside of the water, wrinkly fingertips didn't confer a performance advantage.
Wow, so the wrinkles actually helped to grasp things underwater.
Exactly.
Why would that be?
Well, that's a great question. And the researchers aren't quite sure. There are a few hypotheses floating around, no pun intended. One, one is that perhaps the wrinkling gives our fingers more surface area, which allow us to get a better grip on things. Maybe it's just that the water washes away some of the oil on our hands, and that gives our hands more friction, which enables us to pick up objects a little bit better. Nobody's really sure why this works. Nobody's also really sure if this is actually something that was conferred by evolution or if it's just some sort of curious side effect of our nervous system. You know, did we actually evolve wrinkly fingers to be able to pick up things underwater? It seems unlikely because it doesn't seem like that's an important thing for us, although maybe our ancestors were trying to, you know, grab a lot of fish underwater. Who knows? But all these mysteries remain to be solved.
All right. Well, sounds like an experiment I'll have to do at home sometime soon.
Yeah, right.
So what else have we had on the site this week?
Well, Carrie, for Science Now, we've got a story on the science of skipping. This is the actual skipping you do with your feet. Also a story about restoring hearing in mice with deafness. And for Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a story about the future of science in India. Also a story about the author of a blog that has been accusing various scientists of fraud. This author has finally revealed himself. You can figure out who that is on the site. And finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science. This week's Science Live is about conflicts of interest in science. What pitfalls do researchers face when they interact with industry? And next week's Science Live is about greenhouse gas emissions. What would it take to phase out these emissions and potentially put a clamp on climate change? So you can check out all these stories on the site.
Great. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Carrie.
David Graham is the online news editor of Science. You can check out all of our news at news.sciencemag.org, including daily stories from Science Now and science policy from Science Insider. While you're there, be sure to check out Science Live, a live chat on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.
And that concludes the January 11th, 2013 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.